And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Many regions of Alaska were hit hard by the Spanish flu in 1918 and then again in a second wave in 1919. Today, we're going to look back at the epidemic that swept through Bristol Bay in 1919 because it's well documented due to the presence of fish canneries in the region. Well, joining us now, Tim Troll, who compiled oral histories, photos, and documents in a book called Bristol Bay, The Great Flu of 1919. And also here with us, Katie Ringsmuth, Alaska's new state historian, but she's also done a lot of work specializing in the histories of Alaska canneries. I want to welcome you both to Juno Afternoon. Thanks for taking time out to share some of the amazing stories, I have to say. Now, Tim, maybe we can start with you. I understand that your book is soon to be in a second printing, so you've already sold your other books.
Well, we didn't print that many, but obviously we did this book, Bristol Bay Remembers. It was sponsored by Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I think you're a little bit garbled on our connection. Maybe you can try to get a little closer to your microphone.
All right, how's this?
That is much better. So the book, it was initially published by the Bristol Bay Native Corporation and some other sponsors. So it's about to come out again, and what's different?
Well, of course, the idea behind the original, we started out of a concern that people in Bristol Bay should remember this event, and we began it in 2018. Published the book in finally in December of 2019. And lo and behold, we have this other COVID-19 flu that obviously came even months later. So a big interest in Bristol Bay and their past history. The first edition sold out. And in the meantime, we found some additional information and thought it would be good to do that in a second edition. So that's what we're doing.
So Katie Ringsmuth, as a historian, why do you think it's so ironic that this book came out before we had this COVID pandemic?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's timing, I guess, is everything. You know, in part, Tim and I, our goal was to commemorate the 100-year anniversary of the flu pandemic in Alaska, in Bristol Bay. And so we had decided to use the NN Cannery project as a platform to be able to remember the people who died, the people who survived, and the people who provided healthcare, this kind of the surprising story there. And then, you know, not very many people were paying attention until, of course, 2020, when the coronavirus began to really impact people's lives. And then all of a sudden, you had people making these connections from the present to the past.
So what do you think about Tim's book, the value of a book that actually has documents? I mean, it really does give us a picture of what other Native communities may have experienced, the helplessness.
Absolutely. I mean, the importance of Tim's book is it allows those voices, those firsthand stories to come out. I mean, when you're talking about the Spanish flu pandemic and you're talking about the millions and millions of people who died, it's really hard to get your head wrapped around it. And what Tim's book does is it gives us a window into this event. It humanizes it, and it allows us, you know, not only to understand what people went through 100 years ago, but it also helps us to, you know, say, yeah, we can get through this too. I mean, that's the amazing thing is that, yes, a lot of people died. In fact, you know, more people per capita than anywhere in the world. And so extraordinary, tragic loss. But it also is a story of survival and survival of, you know, the youngest among them. And that's what really, I think, gives me hope, especially as a mother of children.
That's right, because the orphans that survived this are the ones who repopulated Bristol Bay. I mean, how many people were lost in this 1919 epidemic? What percentage of lives were lost in Bristol Bay among Alaska Natives?
Well, probably nobody really knows. I mean, obviously there are stories out in Dillingham when I lived there about mass graves. Generally about 40% of the adult population, some people thought, but we really don't know because we have some idea from where the canneries were located in the communities close to the coast, but more than likely it also spread back into the wilderness and we don't really know.
You know, in places... I'm sorry.
We know that many villages did disappear during this period.
That's what I was going to say, especially up north. And do you think that the presence of the canneries perhaps helped prevent total devastation in Bristol Bay?
I do think that's probably one difference between what happened in the northwest of the state, Seward Peninsula, where it was also devastating in the fall and winter of 1918. The canneries coming in May of 1919, when they confronted the disease, they were really the only entity capable of that. I mean, they had these towns and hospitals, and fortunately, they did respond. I mean, they didn't have to, but they did respond. They made their hospitals, their doctors available to people. Cannery workers got very much involved in burying the dead and then also housing the orphans, at least until the end of the salmon season, when they were all then, those that could be collected were sent to a small little hospital in Dillingham, where an orphanage was then created, and life began again in Bristol Bay.
You know,
so yes, I mean, no question that the cannery response was, I think, accounted for the survival of certainly the kids.
Well, a lot of people have wondered, though, is maybe it was the canneries that brought the epidemic to Bristol Bay in the first place. So maybe they should have been responsible.
Well, we don't know that for sure. I mean, there's an interesting, you know, this Dr. French in Dillingham, he was the only doctor. It was a government hospital. There was a small hospital there, himself and two nurses. But in the winter of 1918, he gets notice that there is this flu going around, basically from a dog team sent by the governor, Governor Riggs at the time. And he writes back to Governor Riggs in December of 1918 that we got your message from your dog team that came down from Marshall. We're taking all these actions to now quarantine the villages. But he does say in his final paragraph, as a means for decreasing the death rate of the natives, I would suggest that all cannery vessels coming into Bristol Bay in the spring be boarded and inspected by a medical officer of the government before any of the cannery employees and crew are permitted to land, more particularly coming this spring. So he recommended that. That, as far as we know, did not happen. We have no records that I've been able to find of any ships arriving in Bristol Bay with the flu, or members of the flu, but we only really have the records of the Alaska Packers Association, and we do know when they arrived, the flu was already there.
So it might have come from multiple sources, perhaps?
It probably came from multiple sources, but I think you would have to say that probably the canneries and or at least some of the ships somewhere probably brought it with them.
So when you look at you know, Dr. French, what do you find remarkable about how this man stepped up to the plate?
Well, it's, you know, I think we see that in our health responders today with COVID. I mean, he was there. He was the only doctor. He had two nurses. And, of course, they were immediately overwhelmed with this disease and actually got sick themselves, fortunately survived. But, you know, he knew these people. He was, you know, in those days, he did house calls. He was doing reindeer, you know, trips, dog team trips to visit people from Ilium, the lake, over to Togiak, all the way down to Ugashi. Huge area. But he really got to know these people personally because it was really a small area. So, you know, he had been there for years beforehand. So I think there was a genuine affection that he had for the people that were there. But basically, he did what he was trained to do. And the nurses did as well. And they're sort of the unsung heroes of some of this event in Bristol Bay.
So they get all of these children that are orphaned, and it falls to him to set up an orphanage. And, of course, what are these children like culturally? Do they speak English?
Well, some did, some didn't. We do have, you know, the census records from 1920, And they do record some 110 orphans now in the Dillingham area at Conackamack. And they did indicate whether they spoke English or not. Most obviously did not. Most of them are coming from villages that were very remote, only speaking Yupik or Dena Ina in the case of Dena Ina communities. So, and of course, many of them didn't have names. So they were given names. That had to have been a traumatic experience, certainly for the children, an overwhelming experience for the doctor and the nurses who had to take it on. Dr. French did retire. He'd already decided to retire from Bristol Bay that spring. So he left probably in August of 1919, but in the meantime had arranged to have the orphanage built. And that all happened primarily in 1920. And then that orphanage became an industrial school and basically was there until almost 1940.
So, Katie, in looking at the role of the canneries in responding, because at that time, you know, there was nothing else but the cannery infrastructure, what surprises you the most about what they did to help?
Well, I think that healthcare was very important to these canners, especially when they were operating away from major population centers. And so they had a healthcare system in place. In fact, the Alaska Packers Association had 7 hospitals across Alaska because they didn't want their own employees to get sick or the fishermen. And oftentimes you had a whole host of things that could go wrong. So in some ways they were prepared for health treatment. And the other thing is that they did provide healthcare to the local residents even before the pandemic. So the canneries did have that service. And so in the what was surprising is just, you know, the scale of course what happened. And then afterwards, I think that the superintendents made the decision to employ the residents year round or in the winter times. And so many of the residents became the caretakers of a cannery that had taken care of them.
Well, one of the things too is, and there's a letter in your book from the governor, I guess, or communication between the governor and a cannery boss about, hey, let us compensate you for the supplies you've given, the things you've done. And what was the cannery's response, Tim?
Well, you know, the nature, this was Governor Riggs at the time, and he was really having a back and forth with the federal government trying to get compensated for the money that the state was spending responding to this flu in 1918-1919, the government being primarily responsible for the health of natives at the time. But the Alaska Packers Association came in, and Governor Riggs was trying to establish a case before Congress, and he wrote to the Alaska Packers Association and said, well, I'll try to get you reimbursed for everything that you did. And Abe Fortman, who was actually the head of the Alaska Packers Association, wrote back and said, we note your suggestion regarding a statement of our company's outlays, but we would prefer not to furnish the same. It would be almost an impossibility to segregate the quantities and costs of food, fuel, drugs, clothing, bedding, and other commodities furnished to the natives during the plague, to say nothing of similar articles which will be given them this winter by our people. We feel ourselves well paid by the knowledge that we were able to relieve the suffering and that our employees carried out the spirit and the wishes of the Alaska Packers Association. So Abe Fortman said, thanks, we did it, but no thanks. So, and that, you know, say it's probably, you know, the state would have been very hard put to compensate them probably for what they did at that time.
Well, Katie, there are some interesting parallels today because a lot of people have been frustrated with the federal government's response. And it's interesting, especially in rural Alaska, where you have Alaska Native health organizations in the hub communities, that they have really been on top of this. What do you think that they took away from the pandemics? Do you think that has really helped them build this infrastructure, the motivation for it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the canneries stopped providing healthcare when the local regions took on that role. So I think the lesson was learned. Absolutely. There's a connection.
So when you look at some of these accounts that are in Tim's book, you know, it sounds absolutely horrible. I mean, people dying within days. Do both of you think that this flu that people experienced was a lot worse? And of course, it was the second wave, so maybe it gained momentum.
Well, there's a couple of differences. One, you know, if you're back then, there's no hope. At least, you know, we have hope. We've had, obviously, the ability now for vaccines and distributing, and we have an entire infrastructure. That didn't exist back then. The big difference probably between that flu and this one is it killed so quickly. And so really it ran its course within 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks. And that was your only way to get out of it was to survive it. Whereas today, obviously we do have the ability to try to prevent it from infecting us. And we have that hope out there. Yeah. And certainly worldwide, it's the Spanish flu killed so many more people than it did in other places than the COVID-19. But we are approaching the, you know, we figure 500 to 600,000 died in the U.S. during the Spanish flu, much smaller population then, but we're approaching that number now with COVID-19.
Katie?
Yeah, I would say too that, you know, we have better communication systems. We have access to, you know, everything from masks to, you know, hand cleanse, you know, sanitizer. So I think that's important to be able to get there. You know, when you look at the historic photos, really the only people who are ever wearing masks are the government healthcare folks. So, you know, even just having access to the basic equipment was really tough for people. So, so I mean, heck, we have Netflix. every time when it gets really tough and I know it's really difficult and it's difficult for my kids and it's hard to work. It's always, I think, good to look at the past and look at how people, you know, survived and dealt with this situation. And again, it's always really important to look to the lessons of the past to help us, you know, create that pathway forward today.
One of the things about Dr. French that we didn't mention is that he was an amateur photographer. And Tim, with your permission, may I put some of those on our website from your book? Because to me, those photos tell the story about what happened and going forward into the future, that it was all on the shoulders of these orphaned children.
No, that'd be fine. And that's what first captivated me about the story, finding that the story had to be told, was seeing these photos. And after looking at them for about a year or so, realizing that these were orphans from the flu and we'd never seen these before. And that was a critical period of time in Bristol Bay's history. World War I had no impact whatsoever on Bristol Bay, but the flu certainly did.
So in wrapping things up, what does this tell you about sort of the historical trauma and the subsequent resilience of people?
Well, Katie, you're the state historian, so I'll let you answer that one.
Well, I would say that both the trauma and the resilience are still with us. And it, again, it's important for us, you know, not to turn away from it, but to really understand what happened so we can, move forward and understand what's happening right now. And I should also point out too, Rhonda, that right there at the Alaska State Museum, the Alaska Packers collection is housed there. And the firsthand reports that Tim and I have been talking about, that's where they live. And the State Museum also has some photographs of the cannery and some of the children and the folks who were coming down from places like Sevenoski. And again, the people of South Naknek have those connections today. And that's very important to who they are.
Well, I want to thank both of you for giving us a window into this period of history, and congratulations on your new job as the state historian. And
oh, thank you.
And Tim, good luck with your book, the second printing of it.
Yeah, well, thank you.
And it comes at a time where we do need to look back and reflect. So thanks very much, both of you, for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Rhonda.